Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
Miguel.
Sometimes he's a GM, sometimes he's a DM, etc.
Sometimes I'm a BM.
Yeah, sometimes, one time, at least. It is the 20th of March, 2024, and we are recording episode 186 of Compare and Campaign. And, you know, McGill, the transcript days are over. I've got no more transcript. We sort of skipped over
really,
the end
it.
Of the transcript there. But, you know, some of these listeners, they might be like, oh, thank God, the transcript days, they're finally over. Well, if you hate the transcript days so much, why didn't you contact us on our Facebook page? Maybe you don't have a Facebook. But I just been like picking at my hair the whole time, being like, oh, is this suck to listen to or what? I don't know. And so what are you going to do?
I was really hoping that you were going to round that off by going, and if you didn't like the transcript, well, you're going to hate what I've got now. And then start reading off something even more in-depth and elaborate.
No. I don't have any of that to do. It's just back to freeforming it and looking at my notes and stuff like that, which the notes, not as in-depth as that transcript. One thing is I was looking over what was left of the transcript, what I sort of skipped over. There's stuff that I should recap that's, like, so crazy that it happened. Like, so I was talking about, you know, they had the platforms up in the trees suspended by chains, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of those, so it was a fire giant up there with two, he was, like, on one big platform, and then on either side of that platform were suspended two smaller platforms that were, had Barl Guras crawling all over them. You know what those are?
Barl Guras, are they the, they're like ape-like demons?
Big, like, gorilla-like.
Red-haired ape, and they, do they have, like, tusks?
Sometimes, probably.
Yeah.
Anyways, Barl Guras crawling all over these platforms, and basically what they did is Connor went and got on the main platform that they were all connected to, and planted a C4 explosive and then fell back and, like, it blew up the whole place and they, like, fell to the ground of the forest and, like, had to keep fighting the demons because the demons still weren't dead even after the fall and everything. And, yeah, that was just one thing that they did. I mentioned during the chariot encounter, they summoned, they used their Horn of Valhalla to summon warriors of Valhalla to fight along their side. You know, things like this, I'm kind of, I kind of breezed past and I didn't properly get into them.
All right. And so this is you correcting the record?
Yeah, just added in things that I missed. I'll tell you.
So, something I missed, Tom, is, this is the end of the transcript. Is that because you started playing in person again? Or is this like, did we reach the hiatus?
Neither.
Neither.
The transcript,
or you started playing
ends,
on like Roll 20 or something.
The transcript ends where it just becomes me and my brother playing for the final operation of this act. So we didn't play on text when we were doing that. And yeah, the hiatus is like still quite a ways off. I mean,
but
I guess it depends how long it takes to me to get through some of this stuff, though.
But the transcript ended because it was just you and your brother playing, and there was no sense in just the two of you doing it all by text. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much, yeah.
And then after that, was it still just continuing with you and your brother until the point where the hiatus arrived?
No.
No.
No, it's after the operation with just me and my brother, which I guess we may get into today. After that, then Spencer joined back in, and we had a few operations, a bunch of operations with Spencer that go into the next and final act.
But you didn't return to text when that happened.
No.
Interesting. Okay.
So no transcript. I did talk about Connor getting his Pegasus. And again, this is all stuff that you technically did when I ran it in Ashes Against the Grain.
Right.
My campaign that you played in. I feel like there was one other thing at least that I wanted to highlight, but maybe you talk for a bit and I'll get back to you on that.
Oh, okay. Well, over in my corner of the show, the RPG Danger Room, I got two little like mini RPGs to talk about. Both of these are from that giant bundle that I have talked about a few times now on the show. The bundle for racial justice and equality that I bought way back in 2020 off of itch.io. And as I've said previously, I bought it because some of the big games that were included with it are all really great games. And like, I paid $5 for this bundle. I would have paid $5 for each of these main games, stuff like Celeste and Overland. And so I bought it for those big titles. And then I just didn't look at it much further because there's about 1,000 different things included in this bundle. It's like an overwhelming amount of content for the price that I paid. And then in looking at Extreme Meat Punks Forever, that's how I discovered that I already owned the video games for Extreme Meat Punks Forever, which in turn inspired me to look closer at the content of this giant bundle, and lo and behold, it is filled with TTRPGs, mini TTRPGs, short little zine bite-sized ones that are exactly the kind of thing that I love to talk about on this show in between deep dives into more complex RPG systems. And so the two mini RPGs that I'm talking about on this episode are as follows. There's one called 6E by Jared Sinclair. It's the sixth edition or so. And one called House by someone called Marn S. What? Well, I hear you going, what about 6E?
What?
Well, 6E is, it's kind of a joke. It's kind of a bit of a gag. It is a D&D-inspired fantasy role-playing game that is actually powered by the apocalypse, and it is a very simple, stripped-down, condensed version of the stuff we like about D&D, but packed into, 11 pages, five of which are character playbooks. So, and one of which is the title page. So it is very stripped down, but I thought it would be fun. I mean, with a title like 6E, you know, of course, because we are on 5th edition, D&D 5E, it's like this guy's skipping ahead to the next edition of D&D before it even exists. Like, already this game is very tongue-in-cheek just by the title. So I thought it would be pretty fun to look at. Even though, Tom, I know you're not keen on stripped-down D&D surrogate RPGs, as you expressed with Cairn.
You know, and I think that was actually, as we sort of discovered, it was more a thing of things that I'm just very familiar with from, like, OSR, that just, like, I don't know.
You were saying about Cairn, you were like, why don't I just play, like, first edition D&D instead of this?
Yeah, which I guess is the sentiment of OSR.
I guess. Well, maybe you will end up liking 6E a bit more than Cairn, because at least it is transplanting the basics of D&D over to a slightly different system, this powered by the apocalypse playbook-based system. And the other game that I've brought to the table, which is called House by Marn S. This is much more of a story-based game. Like you don't really have a character sheet. You do sort of like a brief write-up of your character, but the game is primarily played with a single sheet of paper and a deck of cards. And it's inspired by stuff like House of Leaves, or another source of inspiration that I hadn't heard of is something called the Dionia House. You know about the Dionia House? Apparently it is a creepypasta, and it's a similar idea to House of Leaves. Just the idea... Yeah, Ben Trout. The interior of the house is strange, and the dimensions of the interior of the house don't really line up with the dimensions of the exterior. And much like House of Leaves, the Dionia House is all told in sort of like epistolary format. It's all like text messages and letters being sent back and forth. It's this real popular idea, I find, in like internet culture these days, especially with things like, you know, the back rooms, this idea of the house that you get trapped in and its dimensions don't line up, and it's this like strange, vaguely haunted liminal space, and maybe there's something in there with you. And so in the game of House, which honestly, describing this game to you, Tom, we might end up just kind of playing it as we go through the source book. The idea behind it is that it's like a map-making game. You use a deck of cards to build a map of the house, and then the characters kind of react to the changes, the ever-changing interior of the house that you're trapped in. So we'll talk a bit about each of these very different games in the RPG Danger Room.
So there was one more thing from my little recap of things that I didn't cover in the transcript, which was I described how they had to sort of assault there was the final push on the mantle where all the fire giants came raging out of the city and they were threatening to like crush the Draelic soldiers. And so the players had a sort of side objective to try and keep the attention of the fire giants by like keeping attacks on them and stuff, keeping them all occupied so that their allies could get away. And one way they did that is, first of all, Gent and Hex basically just kicked the crap out of the demon commander that was leading them. But then Connor came down on his Pegasus, you, and used the Rod of Rulership that he took out of the armory way back at the beginning of the operation, and used it to turn almost all the fire giants against one another, making them fight each other as allies.
Hell yeah.
So, just totally turning the tables of the final encounter there.
Sounds OP.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
So do we want to start with More Coyotes Aegis, or because I've got these two short form things, we could always make like a Coyotes Aegis sandwich between other RPGs.
Yeah, let's make the sandwich. Why not?
All right. Here, let me send you a copy of 6e to look at. So 6e by Jared Sinclair. It's just like, it's an 11-page source book. You can get it right off of Itch for $6. And here, of course, it's $6. It's 6e. And here's just a little write-up on it straight from Itch. It's the 6th edition or so. This is a fantasy role-playing game. It's powered by the apocalypse. But don't worry if you don't know what that means. It's simple, and it's got lots of places for you and your friends to make it your own. There are 5 different character sheets, one of each for cleric, fighter, thief, wizard, and DM. There are no separate rules text. It's all on the sheets. So this is like a self-contained little thing, and like literally there aren't any rules outside of all these playbooks. It starts off with the Dungeon Master sheet, which has most of the rules on it, but like the DM's sheet, it's got like a space for notes, it's got some lists and stuff. It's effectively the DM sheet is like a DM screen. But let's go through it, just starting with the Dungeon Master. Here's what you need to know. It's a fantasy role-playing game, and your job is to make sure it's awesome. Jared says, I'm going to help you as much as I can, but ultimately it's up to you and your friends. Read over the sheet, skim the classes. I'm sure you'll do great. So the basic move that is the core of the game is something like this. When you do something risky or dangerous, you roll 2d6 and you add a relevant attribute score. On a 12 or more, you do it perfectly. On a 10 or 11, you do it... On a 12 or more, you do it perfectly with an additional benefit. On a 10 or 11, you do it perfectly. On a 7 or 9, you do it, but with some cost or complication. And on a 6 or less, you fail to do it with some additional negative consequence. Just tell them something dangerous is happening and ask, what do you do? Now, right away, this is, you know, we've talked about Powered by the Apocalypse, and we've talked about Forged in the Dark. It seems like this kind of scale, this range for the dice, is a real common factor between those systems. Just the idea of the 4 ranks, right? It's the same as critical, success, mixed, and failure. Same idea. When you fight an enemy in melee, you roll plus your strength. A 7 to 9 might mean that you successfully do damage to the enemy, but they do damage to you or disarm you. A 6 or less might mean that you don't damage your enemy and they do damage to you and knock you prone. So that's an example. There are a few more examples here, but like, I feel like based on everything we've talked about, like, we get it. Our listeners must get it. At this point, anyway. Character creation, real simple. Choose a class. You get the appropriate playbook or class sheet. And then the DM asks the player to choose a class advancement. And then you tell them how to roll their attributes. So for each one in order, they roll 2d6. And the attributes are not, you don't put a number, you put like the bonus or the penalty to it. Again, very similar to other RPGs we've covered even recently. So like if they roll 2d6 and they get an 11 or more, they have a +2 for that attribute. On a 9 or a 10, it's +1. A 6 to 8, it's +0. 4 or 5, it's -1. And 3 or less, it's -2. Then they roll their HP, they roll a number of d6s equal to their level plus their constitution. And then they keep a number equal to their level. Write down the result in the HP bubble. Inventory slots, everyone has a number of slots equal to 12 plus their strength for inventory. You know, higher the strength, the better the carrying capacity. Tell players to strike through the numbers for slots they don't have. Some large items might take up 2 slots. If they're ever carrying more stuff than their slots allow, they get a -2 to all rolls. Everyone starts with 1 or 2 remarkable items. There are some examples, but don't worry about boring stuff like weapons and armor and torches. Players can use their gear bubbles for that. And for remarkable items, this is one where you make up your own. There are some examples here, but, you know, it's a normal item that gives you a bonus in a specific circumstance, and the players can just make up their own, or the DM can suggest one of these. I like that the rules say, suggest one of these, and then pretend you made it up on the spot. You'll look so clever. But there are things like the quick pick, +1 when you need to open a lock quick or quiet so no one notices. The fancy hat, plus one when you're making a deal with a merchant or statesman. Mercurial Wand. Once per day, you can use this to cast a random spell from the wizard spell list. You better roll for it. So just like basic magic items, special items that give a bonus, and you can come up with your own. And then on the subsequent page, I guess, which is the flip side of the DM's sheet, there's a much longer gear list. There are some light weapons. They describe, like, what fits as a light weapon. Daggers, short swords, hand axes. Can be wielded as an offhanded weapon, allowing you to reroll damage once per attack. Things like martial weapons, long swords, axes, hammers, and spears. Wielded in your main hand and gives plus one to damage. I won't go through all of them, but it's just, it's like rules for all of the base kind of D&D equipment. And then there's even a list for other miscellaneous things like rope, chalk, parchment, a tent, dice, animal traps, fishing poles, shovels, clothes, a cart, a sand timer. When you need a standard piece of mundane adventuring gear that's not in your inventory, you fill in an empty bubble to declare that you had the item all along. Again, very similar to things like Forged in the Dark. When you're in town, you can spend 25 gold to empty all of your equipment bubbles. So that's how you make up the gear slots. It actually costs you in-game currency as opposed to just refreshing it in like an aftermath phase at the end of the game cycle. There are some frequently asked questions about spells. I like this question. It says, my players did a weird thing and there's not a move for this. Well, that's great. Make up a cool one together.
I don't get the damage rule.
The damage rule?
As far as I can tell, there isn't one. Like, it says, light weapon says I can reroll damage once per attack. When am I rolling damage?
The damage die is on each of the playbooks. Each class has a different value of damage die.
Now I've got it.
Yeah. So each class has a different value of damage die. For example, cleric has a d6. Fighter has a d8. We'll just go through all of them. Thief is a d6. Wizard is a d4. So those are your different ranges of damage. I guess that makes sense, right? Fighter would do the most damage. And then there are, you know, the little bonuses that you get from various equipment that might add or even subtract.
Or let you reroll.
And then similar to, well, it's powered by the apocalypse, right? So like we were just talking about Extreme Meat Punks Forever. Just like that, 6E has some basic moves and then some specific moves that vary depending on your class, except because this is a stripped down version, it's even more basic. So the basic move is literally roll 2d6 and add a relevant attribute score. And then the cleric has a couple of moves here. So cleric moves, when you spend an hour or so in silent communion with your deity, you forget any spells you have already memorized and may memorize a number of spells equal to your level plus your wisdom. You can choose any spell on the cleric spell list. I really do recommend getting a better list, though. So there is a built-in cleric spell list here of 10 different spells. Things like cure disease, hold person, remove curse, silence. But right at the top it says, ask your GM to make a better list. I do appreciate how this is giving us, like, the bare-bones structure, but then they keep on saying things like, you know, you could get your GM can do a better job than this. And all of the, I'll go over the second page on the class sheet as well. Cleric here, he's got three bubbles for gear. Experience. When you get money from the wilderness or the underground and bring it back to town, you gain one experience for each gold you got. Make sure to write it down. When you have experience equal to 1,000 times your current level, you level up. Mark a new ability from the cleric advancement list. And then there's a list of cleric advancements. Again, it says, work with the GM to come up with something cooler. So if you don't like any of these, the GM, you can collaborate with the GM. But they are all things like gain plus one wisdom, gain plus one strength, gain plus one charisma. Add a random wizard spell to your deity's spell list. Turn undead. Divine armor. All stuff that you are very familiar with if you've ever played D&D. A few other notes. And these are all pertaining to the cleric here. So other stuff, when you take time to rest and consume a ration, you may re-roll your HP. Roll a number of dice equal to your level plus your con, and keep a number of them equal to your level. Write the result as your new HP. When you need a standard piece of mundane adventuring gear that's not in your inventory, fill in an empty bubble, declare that you had it all along. When you're in town, you can spend 25 gold to empty all of the equipment bubbles. I guess we covered all of that on the DM sheet as well. Just repeating myself a bit. And it seems like that's the way it goes with all of the classes. They have some slight differences. Obviously, there are different class-specific moves. Something that I think is fun here, like, for example, on the fighter sheet. So the fighter moves are, when you get a 12 or more on an attack roll with a remarkable weapon, in addition to the normal effects, you may impress, dismay, or frighten your enemy.
I like this and one, when when you kill an enemy, you can make up like a part of its technique that you steal, and then you can in the future use that technique to get a bonus.
That's right. When you use that move, add one to your roll, and you can have a number of these moves at a time equal to your level. So the more enemies you fight, the more elaborate your fighting techniques become. You learn their moves and can apply them to your own technique. For like the fighter advancements, it's a lot of the same sorts of bonuses. Plus one constitution, plus one strength, plus one charisma, deal plus one damage.
Yeah, but none of the spell stuff.
But none of the spell stuff. And a lot of what I'm noticing here is that the cleric only really had one advancement that was repeated, which was studious, add a random spell to your deity spell list. So you could take that more than once to get multiple spells. But I see here that the fighter has has more repeats like that designed to stack. So like you can take the ability dangerous twice. Each time it gives you an additional plus one to your damage. You can take soldier twice. Each time armor takes up one fewer inventory slot.
And that's it.
And that's it.
It has one more than the other.
Fine, Tom. Fine. I'm just saying, looking ahead, though, it would appear that is it. That the fighter has more repeated advancements than any other class. In fact, I don't think, just skimming these, it doesn't appear that any other class actually even offers repeated ones. The cleric has studious, which you can take twice, but the fighter has two abilities that you can take twice, more than any of the other classes.
Stack them up,
or work with the GM to come up with something cooler, of course. Thief has a sneak attack, has just a full-on, like, sneaky hide, passing unnoticed. And instead of the technique list, the thief has a connections list. You know a guy. When you know a guy, roll plus your charisma. On a 7 or 9, the person you know seems to think you owe them a debt. On a 6 or less, they want a lot more than that. Write down your connections and any notes you like to the right. Thieves have plus one dex, plus one wisdom, plus one charisma as advancements. Light-footed, light armor takes no inventory slots. Marksman, you deal plus two damage with ranged weapons. Assassin, when you roll a 12 or more to attack someone unaware, add another 1d6 to your damage. And then finally, the wizard. The wizard is sort of like the cleric in how they function. They get, I think, the most gear slots of anybody. Yes, the wizard gets the most gear slots of any class. They have, similar to the cleric, like a thing where they study their spell book to memorize new spells. They can add a spell to their spell book from scrolls or other wizard spell books using a roll. And then there's a big old list of wizard spells, and these, again, are all very familiar to anybody who has played D&D. Detect magic, missile, Raise the Dead, Spider Climb, Sleep, Adhere. There's even Floating Disc, I guess this variation of Tensor's Floating Disc. And once again, all the advancements, there are a lot of attribute bonuses that make sense. Wisdom, Intelligence, Dexterity. There's a cross-disciplinary ability where you can choose a cleric spell, which I guess the cleric had the wizard version of that, and also wizards have that studious ability where they can add a random wizard spell to their spell book. There is a detect magic cantrip that you can take, arcane armor, wild magic, and of course you can work with the GM to come up with something cooler. So, and that's it. That's literally everything that is in this little mini game. It's essentially five playbooks, one of which is a DM screen. They give you the basic rules to launch yourself into the most stripped down version of a D&D game that you could possibly want, with a few variations on how the mechanics work. But I mean, I think this is fun. I think this is neat. Like, going back to things we've said previously, I don't know if I'm going to, like, leap to play this right away. But this is definitely a case where if I had a group of friends together and they're like, we all want to play D&D, but we only have 2 hours to do it. Well, if you're playing actual D&D, it can take an hour just to make your character. It could take 2 hours to make your character, depending on how focused you are and how much you want to, like, really get into the crunch of all of it. But if you want something where it's like, we just want to play D&D style fantasy characters in the basic D&D classes and go on a little mission, I feel like you could throw this together in 10 minutes and be off to the races almost instantly. I think it would be a real fast and easy way to leap into it. But I also know that this maybe isn't your cup of tea. I don't know, Tom, what do you think of this thing?
I tell you what is, I think that you wouldn't be able to run this on startplaying.com because it'd be a real conflict of interest to just have your game called 6E in the search engine. I've been looking at this. That got me onto a whole tangent where I'm just looking at all the different things, all the different games that they have on Start Playing. One thing I notice is, like, some games that, like, I don't think that anybody's playing, they've just, like, there'll just be, like, one game that doesn't look like it's connected to that game at all that just comes up anyway.
Okay. I feel like you might be able to play this if you were able to enter in 6E by Jared Sinclair. I think that might be the distinguishing factor that you need.
Maybe. Oh, man.
In a way, calling this 6E kind of does it a disservice because, I mean, while it is very D&D-like, the actual mechanics are not D&D-like at all.
Powered by the Apocalypse.
Powered by the Apocalypse. But I guess it is very cheeky, this idea that Jared Sinclair got to 6E before Hasbro did, before Wizards of the Coast did. I don't know, Tom. What do you think of it?
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I find it interesting that it has a generic move that just sort of covers everything as a Powered by the Apocalypse game.
It is sort of a stripped-down Powered by the Apocalypse as well, isn't it?
Well, in a fantasy setting, certainly, I think.
But like you said, like, there's just, like, a single basic move.
Yeah,
as opposed
even,
to something like, you know,
you
we
mean.
Just
even,
looked at Meat Punks Forever,
a...
and that had, you know, at least a half dozen moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean now. The like, as a Powered by the Apocalypse game, even that, it is stripped down. Yeah, I don't know. It seems cool, like, It's actually, you know, I am in a place where I'm looking for something that is like Dungeons and Dragons but simpler. So it's not entirely unpalatable to me.
Yes, that's true.
It's just the thing is, I'm just not totally sold on Powered by the Apocalypse. Mainly it's the statuses, you know? I guess this game has HP, right?
Yeah, this game doesn't have statuses. It just has straight up HP.
Interesting. I don't know. I guess what I would like they roll for their attributes. I would want a point buy system, but I might be able to figure that out. You know, sort of.
Yeah, you could base you it could off very the
spread that you get in Extreme Meat Punks Forever, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Is instead of having them roll for it, you really could just be like, okay, you get there are six stats. You get 2 plus 0s, 1 minus 1, 2 plus 1s, and 1 plus 2.
So in a way, it's actually like maybe the most accessible power by the apocalypse has ever been for me.
Well, how about that?
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Something that another facet of this that I like, that I thought was kind of neat and relates a bit to, I think it was Sentai and Sensibility that we were talking about, is just the different values for the damage dice per class. And also, depending on the class, you get more or less gear, more or fewer gear slots. I like that. I like that variability where it adds a certain balance to the game where, like, of course, the fighter is going to deal more damage, but specifically, like, they're even rolling a different die than everybody else as their single damage die. And then wizards can carry more stuff than thieves even. It just adds a balance to the game that I like. It's a consideration that you wouldn't necessarily have to make in something like Dungeons & Dragons. Anyway, that's 6E by Jared Sinclair. It is on itch.io, and I think it's kind of neat. I feel like there really is a place for these kinds of like micro D&D games. Specifically that place being like, if people want to play D&D and you don't have anything prepared in advance, this is a quick way that you could actually get into a game without having to really prep anything.
I think this would also be like a, I don't know, depending on the size of your, like, I feel like you'd have to have a pretty small group, but if you were trying to get a group that you play 5e with familiarized with Powered by the Apocalypse instead, this might be a good transition stage.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So are we back to Coyote's Aegis?
I guess so. Coyote's Aegis, which might actually be played in the future using 6E, apparently.
No, I don't know about that. I think I'm still leaning Forged in the Dark, but...
Well, fair enough.
What are you going to do? Yeah, I had this idea that, like, maybe... I don't know. The thing is, it'd be good... Like, because I've been looking at all the stuff for... sorry. Wicked Ones. And all the delve deeper stuff like Valiant Ones. Like, there's a reverse Wicked Ones in the full version of Wicked Ones. That, like, and the playbooks for that are just like Monk, Artificer, Warrior, Cleric, all stuff like that. The thing is, and like that might be, because I was thinking of running a game of Wicked Ones, like a game based on Wicked Ones, but then doing it as like Rebellious Ones. And what it actually is like, there's like, maybe you're caught between two warring factions and you like form like a local guerrilla resistance or something. And like, that's sort of the focus of the game. But then the idea is like not that you are monsters, but that you are like rebels, you know? And that would be easier to play based on Wicked Ones using Valiant Ones. But here's the thing, is nobody's made the Valiant Ones playbooks on Rule 20 or anything, you know?
All like, right, of course.
They've done base Wicked Ones, but they haven't done the expanded stuff for Wicked Ones. It's also like you couldn't get the playbooks for the expanded monsters in Roll 20 either. And so it's a tricky thing of like, how well could my vision manifest if I'm just using the Wicked Ones rules and basically just saying these, we're like tweaking this basically. I feel like I want to like test it out with a group or something, but I don't know when I'd ever have time for that.
Now, you have, you've mentioned it a couple of times on this show already, and we talked about it previously on different episodes, but you're going to be running games on startplaying.com, right?
I mean, I'm looking at it. I haven't got it set up yet, and I have to, like, decide on a game before I, like, schedule one, you know? But I was thinking, this is kind of what I was talking about, is like, yeah, I want to test out this game idea before I maybe run it out in the wild, potentially for $5 a session of per player.
I'm really curious to see how that experience goes.
But also, you know, there's the whole payment process set up, you know, I gotta get through that.
Yeah, any kind of e-commerce like that can be a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
But Tom, this could be your this could be it. This could be how you get paid to DM. It's like a dream come true.
Yeah, it could happen. Theoretically. McGill, when I was designing the final operation in Agalloch with the mantle is technically not the final operation of the act. I keep forgetting. Act 5 continues a bit beyond the end of the operations in Agalloch. But so last episode, by taking out the defensive platforms with the giants, letting the army in, fighting off the fire giants that were defending the city. The city is now fully besieged. MPOC has, like, the Draelic army basically has the city on lockdown. But the city itself is teeming with demons. It's teeming with demons. Let's be honest. And
teeming with demons?
Teeming with demons.
Clearly, they need a javelin from a javelin.
They'll get it. Don't worry. But we still have, you know, we know Gratzt is in the realm of Drail. Gratzt, the demon prince himself, is somewhere in the mantle, probably in the biggest, you know, castle in there. And so this final operation is like, all right, we gotta push in, we gotta secure our footholds throughout the city, push forward on this castle, make sure that we've got no threats that have gone overlooked in the city, and we gotta beat Gratzt, and it's really kind of crazy. There's a lot to this operation. I was actually noting as a point, like, so that last one that I did, Operation Riverbed, that in my notebook is 1, 2. So part one is like 1.5 pages. Then part two is 1 page. Part three is 1 page. This one, the whole operation, is 1, 2, 3, 4, about 4.5 pages. So it's another biggie, but of course this is like the big finale. But when I was designing this operation Brittleheart, I think I went a bit crazy, McGill. I think I went a little meat mad.
Oh, let me guess. You didn't just use the whole meat. You're using the whole meat from multiple modules.
Sort of. I went, so, you know, I take the Adventurers League stuff modules and I convert them into this. For this one, God, what is... I think this one is called Assault on Maramidra. Let me just try and confirm that. Yeah, Assault on Maramidra. Maramidra, however you want to call it. And it is that, but... Also around the time that I was transcribing these, like taking all the notes down for what these operations would be, I found in the Adventurers League, like, this other content that was basically just, like, a collection of all the content from, like, previous seasons of the Adventurers League that I had not, like, seen in its entirety. And I saw that meet, and I was like, I gotta use it. Similarly, part of this was there was a set of like 10 pre-gen characters. And I was like, I'm going to find a way to use that as meat. This actually came up.
Pre-gen characters?
This came up back when we were talking about the Verdant Apocalypse. And we were ending the Verdant Apocalypse and leading up to the big battle. I was talking about how I was going to have, like, introduce new characters around the battle. And I was wondering if it would be a bit too much. And you were like, no, just have, like, interesting sort of vignettes with each of these characters. And it'll actually make the whole battle feel, like, give it more character. Because they'll have association with, like, some of the people in it.
Hey, I stand by those words that I don't fully remember saying.
Well, so... Included, basically, before this operation, I had, like, a huge outpouring of just, like, stuff. So I've got in my notes 60 hours pre-battle. They've got, they get added to, like, they get control of a couple of veterans, 3 mules, 3 ponies, and 3 riding horses. These are just in case they need any of these things during the battle. They get advantage on all op. They have advantage on deception, persuasion, and intimidate with all their fellow, like, Draelic soldiers and everything, basically. You know, their word is law out in the battlefield at this point. All operation short rests are free. Didn't have any warlocks, so didn't have anybody who was, like, recharging spells on short rest, so that wasn't much of a, like, crazy thing. And eventually you run out of hit dice, right? So, then they basically, I opened up the armory to them and said, like, the armory has gathered together all these magic items and stuff from all these different worlds for the party to have access to for this big final battle with Gradz. These included a resurrection token, which is a silver token with a porcelain dove inlay that can be used to resurrect someone, basically. 30 levels of elemental evil spells, which can be used by druids, wizards, or sorcerers, max level of 7. 6 first level spell scrolls, 6 carrion crawler mucus. This was all just, like, laid out on, like, a table for them, basically. 6 serpent's venoms. These are poisons. A +2 weapon with 50-foot orc detection and +2 d6 against orcs. Dwarven plate, you know, that I think Connor actually took. A +1 maul called the Smasher that also functions as a decanter of endless potent dwarven spirits. If you use the command phrase, this celebration isn't going to start itself. This is all stuff that was just, like, in the Adventurers League, and I was like, this is awesome. Why? How did I miss all this? I
you
gave...
know, Tom, something occurs to me though is I do feel, I know I've mentioned it previously, but I almost feel like at this point in the game, like how do you even keep track of all your equipment?
Well, part of this is that then they end up meeting all these new agents that are going to be that they're going to be working with them in the field. And then they sort of like a lot of this stuff, they ended up equipping the agents with like powerful magic items to make them more effective.
Man, you know, I hadn't considered that, but it's not something I've ever done. But I really like that idea. I like this idea of giving the players a wealth of equipment and then being like, and now you have to assign it to all of these people who are going to be working under you. That's a neat way of doing it instead of just being like, here's a pile of loot, take what you like.
It is very Jagged Alliance, because in Jagged Alliance, you go around equipping your militias that you've raised in the different areas that you're defending. So many things. Like, I gave them... there was a thing where they had, like, there was a weapon that was basically, like, they were warned, like, I don't know if you want to touch this one, and they basically had to, like, sort of persuade their way into getting it. And it is the blade Hazaron, which appears in the Horde of the Dragon Queen, and maybe Rise of the Tiamat. And if anybody who hears that is like, Hazaron, what the heck? That's like a super powerful magic item. It's like a great sword that's like sentient. And like, yeah, I just threw it in there because it was in the list. I gave them... someone was actually attempting to smuggle a reality bomb. It's like... It was in the... Oh, man. How do I even describe this? I guess I should say... So... I should introduce these characters that they met. They met all these new characters. Gael Ogolokanu, a Goliath great weapon fighter, acolyte of Nuada and brother of Lotam, neutral alignment, ex-Draelic army serving Nuada. Like, I basically took all the unique elements from these character sheets and incorporated them into these NPCs. But one of these characters, his whole thing was that he's actually a smuggler. And he, this, like, Fire Genasi wizard, actually is attempting to smuggle this reality bomb, which is, like, secretly his, like, his character motivation is, like, he's been trying to get this reality bomb. And the players find it, and they're like, what the fuck are you up to? And end up seizing it from him. God, so much stuff. Plus one storm boomerang made from griffin bone. A sapphire water elemental gem. A seeker dark tankard of plenty. Plus one white dragon scale. Dragon gleam, which is a dope-ass spear that can cast daylight, which Connor has been using lately to dispel darkness, and it's pretty great. I gave him all the dragon masks. I gave him the mask of the Dragon Queen. Gent wears it now. It's crazy. I gave him everything, man. A lot of those dragon
masks. And they
masks,
gave me nothing in return.
A lot of those dragon masks went to the NPCs to allow them to make saves that they otherwise would fail. Yeah, Hex got the Insignia of Claws. That was a good fit for him. Insignia of Claws, classic little-known 5e magic weapon that's, like, I think also from Horde of the Dragon Queen or something like that. But, yeah, I restocked them on brain caps, those things that, like, they eat to sort of cure insanity or, like, stave off insanity. And then they met these 10... Level 1 adventurers, these new MPOC agents that were going to help them out in the field. And, like, they go to a big meeting out in Omega Base, and, like, everybody's there. I'm talking Coyote, Chessy, Al, Professor Nesne and Rob Fling, someone named Keg, that I have a question mark over for some reason, Morgar, Gog, Alistair, Goulet, Queen Issa, Trey. At this time, I actually had King Cap slash Queen Issa because I didn't know who the players were going to side with back when I wrote this this adventure. But that was like, that was ages ago, right?
Tom, how far in advance do you write your adventures?
At the time that I did, this was the last one that I did that I wrote, like, everything at the start of the act.
Wow, okay.
The Illithids of the Den were there. Kalkin was there. Tusk was there. Arthur was there. Lovecrafter I-Chan was there. Spymaster D was there. Zeth Hexnat was there. Some Drow Aphrodite Bladesingers were there. Thanks, Chessy. I have in brackets. She called them in. Then, it's actually an interesting thing. So it was sort of this big rallying, like this big rally in the at Omega Base. Everyone's getting ready for the final battle. And there's people just like sitting around. So, and Professor Nesne and Rob Fling and his daughter, Sue, who Hex was training in gunsmithing once upon a time, they've got seats up like on top of one of the buildings on the base. And I remember him going and talking to them, and they were like, "Yep, it's all building up to the big finale." Professor Nesne and Rob Fling gave them a side objective, which is actually to put the mummy Jill Rob Fling, an old ancestor of his, to rest. So in the City of the Mantle, somewhere beneath the City of the Mantle, there is a mummy that is actually an ancestor of Professor Nesne and Rob Fling's that they, before going to defeat Gratz, they'll have to go into the catacombs and put that mummy to rest if they want to complete this side objective. I'll say straight up, I'm pretty sure my brother completed all the side objectives.
Oh, full meat and a rinse.
Yeah, there was the drow, there was a human soldier who said that there was like a drow VIP that was being held within the castle that Gratz was believed to be in. So they were given that side objective too. Then the way this operation broke down is basically they had six objectives. The first four okay, I'll just do them in order. So objective one, North Foothold, referred by Kalkin. And there's a whole, like, basically for each point in this battle, there was the NPC that referred them to that point, like, who briefed them, basically. But then there was also listed, like, an intel difficulty role, like a DC for an intel check that was like how much you know about that point in the battle before you go into it. And so we start off with Kalkin referring them to the North Foothold, Arthur referring them to the East Foothold, Spymaster D referring them to the West Foothold. Then there's the supply chain, which has a lower intelligence DC but isn't referred to them by any particular character. There is, however, a side quest that they get issued when they do that that part of the battle. This is like a lot. There's the Underdark Passage, always with the Underdark Passages, referred by Lovecrafter I-Chan. And then there's the mummy that we've already gotten sort of as a side objective, but as a main objective is referred by Tusk, the orc. So, in Agalloch, after each objective, I'm allowing them a 1 hour long, like the effects of a long rest, with just 1 hour. However, spending an hour in Agalloch this way subjects them to an extremely high wisdom save versus madness, because Gratzt himself is in the mantle. He's like distorting the whole of reality with madness effects. Wild beasts are frenzying throughout the air. These are just regional effects of Gratzt being around. Wild beasts are frenzying. All surfaces are becoming hyper-reflective, so the city of the mantle is now like shining really weirdly and like reflecting. Again, big shout out. A lot of this is all coming from the assault on Maramidra, and a lot of this is like, you know, the players are supposed to pick which entrance they want to do, and then they hit a certain number of encounters along the way as a result. But whole meat. Use that whole meat.
All the meat.
Any questions or comments so far?
Just to clarify again, Spencer is now playing?
No.
At this point in the game? No, this is still just you and your brother.
This is just me and my brother for this op.
But having ditched the transcript because you were playing in person or online.
Yeah.
Like voice chat.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of meat, and I'm a bit amused by this idea that your brother is controlling how many characters now? Three? Four? Three.
Just two.
Just two?
Yeah. He's playing Hex and Connor, and I'm playing Gent.
You're playing Gent, right. Okay, you're playing Gent. And then on top of that are all the base NPCs for the adventure. And then on top of that are the 10 prefab characters who are going to be commanded by Alex, right?
Basically, yeah.
Man, you really did go overboard with the meat.
Yeah, I served it up. Maybe that too
is,
much.
That is, because that's the thing that I keep on thinking about, and, you know, the reason that I was commenting on, like, oh man, that's so much equipment. I just know from experience, from my own playing and also DMing for players, that once they hit a certain amount of loot, a certain number of items, they keep on forgetting things. They just get lost in the big old bag of items. And I can only imagine how tricky it was to keep just all those balls in the air, to keep track of all of that. You got all these characters and all these pieces of equipment that modify those characters, and there was just the two of you, you and your brother, running it all. It's a lot.
Yeah, treating it like just some sort of tactical game. Yeah, MPOC versus Gratzt. Gratzt. Weird name. So, the North Foothold, first objective. It's got a gateway. I mean, I'll hit you with the description from the module, Assault on Maramidra, Northern Forward Base. The cave is a little more than a widened area of the tunnel, and your foes have erected a wall that does not quite reach the ceiling. The wall is made of mortared stone with twisted and sharp bits of rusted metal studded into it. A thick iron gate provides a passage through, but two demonic faces forged of red-hot iron hang on the wall, flanking the gate. So they have this gateway that's sort of manned by fire giants, I think I'm part of my problem here is that the notes like spill onto the next page. Yeah, basically those demonic faces hanging on the walls that the description mentioned, those are like magical sensors that launch they animate and attack firing like they can do sort of like blasts at players in addition to all the giants, which I had. I should reiterate that in this campaign, the fire giants are not merely fire giants. In the module, some of them are fire giants and some of them are demon-blooded fire giants. Or I think specifically it's fiend-born fire giants and fiend-born... Or fiend-born fire giants, and fire giant whelps. Those are like the three things I see here. I mean, maybe all of them are supposed to be fiend-born. Point being, they're crazy mutant demonic fire giants. And I, like, really played that up. If you see in the pictures in our show notes, I was using the pictures of, like, the crazy giant ogre guys from Madness. So, they end up having to secure the first... This is, like, the first area that they secure is, like, this passageway that has... I should also say, like, the module is all in the Underdark, so it's passageways and stuff. But in the game as we run it, it was actually, like, in the streets of the Mantle as a city. And so this is all, like, you know, very kind of, like, war-style environs is, like, you have, like, a blockade in the streets and, a squad moves up to it and then, like, the defenders move out. And we have just, like, a complete skirmish out in the streets. That's what's going on here. And so we secure the northern entrance to the city first. Then we secure the eastern entrance, which is, like, that area. The streets have been, like, totally blown to crap and are all like muddy and full of pools of water, but actually in the mud and pools of water there are more enemies hiding that like rise out of the mud and stuff, and everybody has to like do battle with like mad Nightside Eclipse soldiers and stuff, and like orc slaves and things like that who come out of the mud. Then the western entrance was actually not even defended by, like, standard... Also, I said Nightside Eclipse earlier. I think I was reading in the wrong part. It was just, like orc mercenaries and, like, more of those mutant giants hiding in the mud. The giants actually hide in a big, like... fake boulder, basically, that they then throw off and are like, and they jump out and attack. But then the western entrance, it's not even like guarded. It's just that coming through the western entrance, there's like all these like polished reflection walls, and then out of them burst a bunch of mad Umber Hulks that just attack out of nowhere because Gratz's influence is driving everything to craziness. They get to the objective, which is the supply line, which they have 1 hour to fortify, along with Myconid support, brought by Queen Issa. And then after they fortified it, that is when, a Cambion, you know, Cambions?
That one doesn't ring a bell. What is a Cambion?
It's like a half demon, spawn. I think
I have to look this up.
Yeah, they're very similar to like incubi and succubi in terms of statistics, as far as I remember. They're real pain in the ass.
Okay, yeah, they are. They're like a humanoid. It looks like they are naturally red. They got some wings.
But yeah, so the players had to have to fortify this supply line, and then it gets hit by this Cambion along with four mad Nightside Eclipse elite who are serving the Cambion. After they have defended that supply line, another Draelic soldier comes rushing to them and pleads with them to rescue. Apparently, there are infants being held in the castle. She says she heard infants crying from inside the castle. And she's like, you have to save the babies that are in that castle. And they're like, damn, okay, we'll see. How are we doing for time here? I think I'm going to break here.
All right. Boy, lots going on there. So much meat.
Man, the Underdark passage. Man, I could actually keep going. I don't know. It's crazy. There's so much going on. Yeah.
Do you want me to talk about House and then we can loop back to it, or?
Nah, we won't loop back to it, but I'll tell you this, is so far they've secured the northern, eastern, and west and western routes into the city, the main streets, and they've secured their supply line, even though it got attacked by a freaking demon and stuff.
It's like all these different kinds of enemies. I guess that, as you said, Grast influence is vast and far-reaching. Tom, can I invite you into this house?
House, okay.
You don't want to play house with me?
We'll see.
So, as I said, this is more of a storytelling game. It is a role-playing game. It's a bit of a map-making game, but it seems like story is at the forefront. Again, this is the game House by Marn S., which you can find on itch.io. And the little blurb on its itch.io page is, this is a story about a house. This is also a game about an eldritch, ever-expanding building that you and your fellow players have entered and are going to investigate and may never find a way out of. It's a game based on House of Leaves and Dionia House for two or more players using pen, paper, and a regular deck of cards. And that is it. That's all it says on the Itch page. And this sourcebook is really stripped down. I haven't even sent you a copy because there's only text on it, and I'm going to be reading a lot of it because a lot of it is sort of narrative stuff. It's a 15-page source book, and this is how it goes. You begin by deciding, actually, I'll say this as well, is if you want, while we do this, Tom, you can respond to these prompts because they sort of indicate what you have to do to set up and play the game. So begin by deciding what the exterior of the house looks like. Is it old? New? Do you often see cars coming and going from the driveway? Is there a picket fence around the perimeter or just a mailbox at the end of a long gravel driveway? Is there a swing set in the yard? How many floors does it have? Where are the windows?
You're asking me?
Those are all the prompts. This is all the text that was on page, I guess it's page 2. Yeah. Make up a house. What does the house look like? Is it big? Is it small? You could base it on a house in your neighborhood, even.
There's a place in the Icelandic town of Eyrarbakki.
Not where I expected to go with this, but okay.
It's called The House. And that's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with The House.
Right on. Oh, it's a heritage museum. One of Iceland's oldest houses. Built in 1765. Nice looking place.
It's just called The House.
It's called The House. I couldn't think of a more appropriate house for the game House. What I won't be reading throughout, I'll read this bit, but after every prompt, there is some discussion from the author that sort of provides an example of what the prompt is asking for. So here is the example. I'm not going to read every one of these. There's a house down the road from me that's had a rust-colored stain running up one side of it for as long as I can remember, maybe since before I was born. I don't think anyone lives there, but I walk past it on my way to the convenience store, and sometimes there are cars in the driveway. There's no fence around it, just some short stone pillars. One has a mailbox in it. The rust-colored stain starts at a window close to the ground, one of those small basement windows. I think I could squeeze through it if I tried. So that's the kind of description that the game is prompting you to do. So the house at Arabaki, just based on what I'm looking at here, so I'd say, you know, this is a very old house, quite possibly the oldest house in Iceland. It has a peaked roof. It looks like it has three stories, though the topmost story may well just be an attic. The house is predominantly charcoal gray or maybe black. It has windows with shutters that the frames and shutters of which are painted white. You can see curtains inside the windows. There is a stout stone well off to the side of it. There is also an adjoining outbuilding. I'm guessing it's the visitor center for this museum. But it's a smaller beige-colored house that is connected to the main building by a small walkway. It looks like it has almost like a widow's walk on top of the walkway.
With an Icelandic flag out front.
That's right, with an Icelandic flag out front, surrounded by green, green grass. It's also next to a church that has a red roof.
That church. So remember, in my vampire game I was running, John, the vampire detective, yeah, had to decide on a place for the vampires to have no fighting.
That's the place.
He chose that church.
That's great. That's nice to have a visual of it. And something that I have noted, I think it must have been when I was talking about the Verdant Apocalypse campaign, was just, I always love drawing upon real world places like that. So it just adds that level of immersion. So it's like, it's not just some church in Iceland. It's that specific church.
Yeah. Doing a lot of that in
World of Darkness.
World of Darkness game that I called Dark Ice.
Nice. Next, gather the other players and decide on your characters. Who are you? How do you know each other? Why are you investigating this house? Do you really believe something is wrong with it? Or are you the skeptic of the group?
Is this just speaking for myself?
Yeah.
I think the house is great.
You think it's great?
I think it's great. If there's a ghost here, I want to hang out with it.
Ah, so you're investigating the house in the hopes of meeting the ghosts that potentially linger there.
I have a positive view on the whole experience.
Right on. Next, if we were playing with a big group, decide when you meet up to enter the house and how each of you prepares for it. What do you bring? Do you meet in broad daylight or the dead of night? Do any of you have second thoughts about going inside? You see what I mean? Like, it is, these prompts are just sort of encouraging you to role play small scenes and tell the story, but at no point are we doing anything with like stats or elaborate character sheets or anything like that. Now is when we actually get to filling something in. So on the piece of paper, you draw a square symbolizing the front room of the house at the bottom edge. Decide as a group what the front room looks like. A small hallway, an expansive foyer. Is it cluttered with objects or why empty and open? Are there, where are the light fixtures? Where are the windows? We could just draw from the TripAdvisor pictures of the house from Iceland.
Oh, yeah.
Then you draw a square of any side connecting to one side of the square you made for the front room. Decide what sort of room it is together. A kitchen, a laundry room, a long hallway, a stairwell leading up to the second floor. So you've got your two starter rooms. You have the entry and then you have an adjoining room. Its purpose is up to the group. Now is when we bring in the deck of cards. Remove the jokers from your deck of cards, shuffle it, and draw one. Let the suit of the card dictate the mood of the scene that plays out in the new room that you've made. So hearts means it is a scene of love, friendship, compromise, bonding, or obsession. Diamonds means it's a scene of willpower, good luck, discovery, a second wind, or greed. Clubs means that it is an emotional conflict, hidden agenda, envy, indecision, or betrayal. And spades, it suggests physical conflict, suffering, doubt, fear, danger, grief, or alienation. Then you let the premise of the scene taking place in your new room be dictated by the card's number. Rather than read out all the different cards, Tom, do you have, pull up a card drawer engine online, draw a random card. And I'm going to go ahead and say that the room that adjoins to the entryway, let's say it's a library.
It's a nine of clubs.
So you enter through the foyer and step into the library. And in there, you hear a noise, a strange noise, a noise from nowhere. And it fills you with a feeling of dread, like an emotional conflict is about to occur.
I don't like that.
And so, mixed in with this, in true House of Leaves fashion, like the narration continues, where the author, Marn S., keeps talking about things about the house. So here are just a few examples of this section where we're drawing the cards. The front door was open when I passed the house today. It was closed when I went back to look after hitting the convenience store. My friend AC said it was closed when he drove past the house on his way to work too, but I swear when I walked past it, that door was open. I stopped to look at it, to see what was inside, but there was nothing there, just darkness. I think the rust-colored stain is bigger again. If the couple who owns the house rented out, why do people go urban exploring there? When's the last time somebody actually lived inside? Isn't it a waste of money to own a property and not do anything with it? Then you keep drawing cards and adding rooms to the house. Proceed to the end game when you run out of room on the paper, when you run out of cards, or when any of the players is just too tired to continue. And so here is the end game. To end the game, you organize all the cards you've drawn by suit. The suit with the most cards drawn dictates what will happen when you try to escape the house. If you've drawn the most hearts, your group is unexpectedly rescued by an ally. Who are they? Were they trapped within the house too? Or have they come from the outside? What is their exit strategy? If diamonds is the predominant suit, you make an escape plan on the fly and are forced to improvise. What's the plan? Who cracks under pressure? And who keeps a cool head? What must you sacrifice? Clubs? An unexpected antagonist causes complications to your escape.
I don't want to hear everything. Should I just roll or draw one of these cards?
No. These are the end games. Basically, so throughout the game, you're building the house and drawing a card every time you add a room. At the very end of the game, you sort all of the cards that you've drawn, and the suit that has the most presence, the you've drawn the most, determines what the end game is. So that's what I'm reading out here is these are the four different end games. Yeah, these are the four different end games. So if you have the most clubs at the end of the game, an unexpected antagonist causes complications to your escape. Who is it? How do they reveal themselves? What's their agenda? Is anyone injured or killed? And finally, if you have the most spades, you must fight your way out of the house with tooth and nail. How does the house fight back? Who gets hurt? Who must stay behind? Who goes back later to rescue them? And so ultimately, like, that's it. That's how it works. This game is one where you do role play scenes. You role play a scene in every room. Everybody's got a character, but there are no attributes. There are no real mechanics beyond add a room to the house, draw a card to determine the mood of the scene, and use the number on the card to sort of give an inciting factor to the scene. Something like a lie uncovered, a grim discovery, a puzzle to solve. You keep role-playing scenes. As you move to each room in the house, you draw the square of the room on your sheet of paper and draw a card, role-play the scene as prompted, and you keep on doing that until you run out of room on your sheet. You've built the whole house, and that's when you sort out all the cards you've drawn and determine what the end game is going to look like, and then you role-play that as well. All story-based, very few mechanics, short little game based on House of Leaves. I think this is, I always say this, but I'm like, I think this is kind of cool. I sort of like this idea.
I think I would have gone for this more when I was into, like, In a Wicked Age and stuff like that. When I was into, like, that more freeform stuff.
More fiasco-y kind of a thing.
Maybe.
Yeah.
There's still a place for Fiasco. I don't know.
Fiasco has more mechanics than this. You actually roll those dice with Fiasco, and the dice have multiple functions. With this, it is literally like draw a room, draw a card,
same can be said
play
of
a
each,
scene.
In a Wicked Age.
No, that is true. That is true. Though even In a Wicked Age has a greater variety of dice. But, I mean, I don't know. Have you ever read House of Leaves?
No.
No. I feel like this is fine, but what I can see here thinking of House of Leaves and then looking at this TTRPG house is it just makes me think like, man, doing a TTRPG that has a bit more crunch to it based on House of Leaves, doing like a map building / paranormal investigator RPG where you're building the map together. I think that there's some real potential in that idea. And this game, House, does play with that, but I almost feel like it doesn't go far enough. I want more, man. It would be neat, because House of Leaves is all about a house that sort of exists in a strange extra-dimensional space. I think it would be pretty cool to do a map making house architecture, like blueprint drawing game, but because it's in extra dimensional space, like if you roll a certain thing or draw a certain card or some trigger, could have it be that you start folding the paper that the map is on and you have to sort of fold it into different shapes and make it more difficult to get back out, something like that. I think that could be pretty neat. So this is one where it's like, I see what they're going for, and be a fine way to, you know, kill an hour or two maybe. But I think that the potential is here for something more elaborate and potentially even more interesting. But that's House by Marn S., also available on itch.io.
Is that the end of our episode?
I think so.
So, if you want to get in touch with us or see when we post new episodes or follow us, check us out on Comparing Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Who knows what they're going to run for their next campaign? Not me.
Level up, get all the meat.
I guess you could.
More meat.